Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Back in the 1960s, there was barely a bigger attraction in Columbus than the star of the 50-50 Club, Ruth Lyons, who broadcast out of Cincinnati and throughout much of the Midwest. Here she is announcing plans for her annual trip to the capital city.
On the 21st of October, we're moving the entire show to Columbus to do the show at wherever, you know, that beautiful Veterans Memorial Hall. We'll do the entire show up there that day, everybody. You will come.
I'll be there, Peter.
Ruby, Marion, Bonnie, the boys in the band. I hope you have no engagements on the 21st of October.
We'll cancel.
If so, you'll cancel them, yes. It accommodates 4,000 people. And the last time we went to Columbus, we had over 40,000 requests.
That's from a new documentary entitled Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. She is called that for good reason. She not only built a television empire, but it is said that Ruth Lyons accidentally invented what we consider the format, the regular format for the daytime TV talk show. You know the format in which the host sits with the guests and talks. But she was much more than that. Joining us now to talk about Ruth Lyons and her amazing career is Mark Magistrelli. He's creator, writer, and producer of the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having us here, Ann.
Also with us by phone from Cincinnati, I think, Mickey Fisher. She's former executive secretary to Ruth Lyons. Welcome to the show, Mickey.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted. I'm so glad you're keeping her music alive and talking about her.
Well, I really had barely heard of her, although I had heard of the Christmas tree song, but I didn't know where it came from. And I learned a lot from the documentary, and I learned a lot about our country during those decades from the documentary. To our listeners, Phil Donahue remembers, Carol Channing remembers, so does David Letterman and Johnny Mathis, Peter Nero, and many more of the talented and famous guests who appeared on the 50-50 Club. Do you remember the queen of television, Ruth Lyons, who hosted the show for 20 years? Give us a call and share your memories. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. She was a force to be reckoned with. Let's talk about Ruth Lyons at her zenith, Mickey Fisher. What did she control? I mean, how do you define her success at its zenith?
Because she was real. I mean, she was just herself. I started the same year that Bob Braun and Peter Grant started on the show in 1957, and most of her songs were written during the time of that 10-year period between the time I joined her and when she retired in 67. So I know all about all the songs. They were, you know, written specifically for, you know, each vocalist on the show. And she just, she was a real person. And she never lied to her audience. She was very honest and open. She was, it was recognizable. I mean, people knew that.
You know, Mark Magistrelli, watching it and understanding more and more about her business acumen and her and everything else that she brought to the table, she's a very complicated person. But she also comes across, maybe in today's vernacular and today's sensibilities, as sort of folksy. But she was very powerful. How did you decide to start the whole documentary about her?
Well, for me, as somebody who's been in broadcasting for, you know, most of my professional life, I found her to be a fascinating transition figure because there's so much about her that was very much the proper Victorian lady, and yet, at the same time, she was this harbinger of, I'm not sure she herself would necessarily put it in these terms, the liberated woman that we began to see emerging in the 1960s. I'm not sure how she would have felt by Betty Friedan, for example, but what was being propounded there, which is, yes, you can do the same things men can do. She was a major station executive in Cincinnati. In 1937, CBS installed her as program director of their owned and operated station there, and it was not, from what I've been able to find out, any sort of figurehead role. She was involved in negotiation with the musicians union, with the actors, with everything that had to do with running a full radio station. I think Bertha Brainerd at NBC was the only other woman to have an executive role that we knew of in American broadcasting at that time. So apart from her prowess as a host, as a songwriter, as an on-air personality, she had the business and organizational background. So when television came in and she gets to do this program, it is less of a formatted show than you and I think of today.
Mm-hmm.
And because of her strong personality and the fact that she already had so much clout from her radio days, she was able to develop the talk show that we know now in two simultaneous directions. One, if you want to call it the star-driven, hi, we're going to bring on Lauren Green or Bob Newhart or Peter Nero, whomever, and sit down and have a chat with them. And at the same time, because she would not be denied a platform for her own views, because I have her on tape somewhere saying, when I'm upset about something, I just can't keep it inside. You're going to learn about it. I've just got to say something about it. So she talks about equality. She talks about race issues. I think the first really warts and all national profile of her that was done, she was talking about Little Rock and about turmoil in, I think it was Yugoslavia at the time. All of that went over the air. The advertisers don't like it. They can go somewhere else because I've got advertisers on a 2-year waiting list to get
on
this program.
I wanted to talk about the whole advertising phenomenon. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And with me in the studio, Mark Magistrelli. He's creator, writer, and producer of the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. Also with us by phone, Mickey Fisher. She's former executive secretary of Ruth Lyons. If you remember the 50-50 show, or the 50-50 club, I should say, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you remember the queen of television, Ruth Lyons? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. So where did she come from, Mark? You said her background in radio. She was a force to be reckoned with before she ever hit the television airwaves.
She was already highly popular on radio. She had started out as an accompanist. She was a pianist, accompanied for, auditions for shows, things like that, and started out as a music librarian in the music department at a radio station, and more or less worked up through the ranks. But the story that everybody seems to agree on is that in 1929, the regular host of a program called The Woman's Hour didn't show up at the studio or couldn't make it that day, and there was a script. And it was probably a very conventional program of the time aimed at what people thought women, and I use it in quotation marks, would be customarily interested in. She looked at the script, threw it aside, and just went on as herself talking about what she found of interest that day. And she didn't stop for the next 37 years.
I know her. She was something of a visionary. She was the program director, one of the few ever at that point. But she wanted more. She was irritated that she wasn't on the board of directors, that she wasn't a vice president of something, that she wasn't really higher up the food chain. In other words, she was aware that there was that glass ceiling there.
Oh, yes. And I think, too, there was a certain sense of she knew that she was the biggest star that the then Crosley Broadcasting Corporation had. And as more than one person told us, rightfully so, if this had been a male, she would have had certain perks, what have you. As it was, she was reasonably well compensated. And again, because she had she was the one who, as you said, formed effectively the empire that allowed her to flourish and, of course, brought great number of profits to the station. So she did have a great deal of clout, but she never got the title that perhaps somebody else different gender would have gotten.
I wanted to hear from the documentary now. She had a feeling about what she wanted people to take away from this, from her show every day. It ran for 90 minutes from noon to 1:30 every day. Let's hear about that.
She wanted the people at home to sense that community of audience and performer and to eavesdrop on that. To be someone who was a guest while we were having a party at noon every day.
I think that's Nick Clooney.
Yes, it is.
And the idea of eavesdropping on a conversation is something we take for granted nowadays in talk shows, but it was revolutionary at the time.
Well, Mickey, you can probably speak more accurately to this than I could, but back in the 1950s, especially at this time, everything for the most part was scripted, and here you are in Cincinnati working with this lady who I think the only equivalent of her at the time was Arthur Godfrey.
I think you're right.
Who did not use a script, and so you couldn't really censor what she was going to say. It went out on the airwaves. And when you have people clamoring to buy the products that you are promoting that don't get on the air without your personally trying and approving them, you have that kind of freedom because you are bringing those kind of dollars into the corporation.
Mickey Fisher, did the guests always know what they were getting into by the time you came along? Was it she's such a well-known commodity that they just knew what they were up were in for? Did the guests?
The guests? Oh, not really, because they, you know, later on they had heard of her, but early in the years, the early 50s, or I guess the mid 50s, they would come on and they hadn't heard of her, but when they left, they praised her. I mean, they wanted to come back. They wanted to be part of that program.
They said she put butts in the seats.
Beg your pardon?
She put butts in the seats. I love that phrase.
Yes,
in other words,
right.
If they came on her show, if they were appearing at a local venue somewhere and they happened to be in town and that's when they appeared
right.
on her show.
They called us.
Well, let me tell you something. One of the people that we were sadly unable to get to because he passed on just before we were scheduling the interview was George Carlin. But I had the opportunity to speak with George's manager about this. And when he spoke to George, he apparently lit up and said, oh, do I remember Ruth Lyons? He had just split from his partner and was making one of his early solo engagements in Dayton, and nothing was selling. It was bombing in big time. And you would not necessarily put George Carlin and Ruth Lyons in the same sentence, but, you know, the worldview is relatively broad, and she looked into the camera, according to George, and said, I don't care what you're doing. This is a funny young man, and I want you to go to Dayton and see him in person because he'll be twice as funny as he is today. And so it finishes, and he drives back, and there's a line. And, yeah, the ladies had shown up because Ruth told them, this is a funny young man. You're going to love it. Go out to Dayton and see him.
And it must be therefore true. Bill in Manchester, welcome to the show. You grew up in Cincinnati.
Yes, I did. I was born and raised in Cincinnati. I formerly worked for the Williamson Furnace Company and did a long stint out in Illinois, but I moved back here because, quote, I wanted to come home. I vividly remember Ruth Lyons because this lady was very kind to children. She was just always had time for children. My aunt, Mary, my mother's older sister, who is deceased now, took me down there when the old Federal Bakery used to be downtown and some other things, and she took me up there to one of the shows. Even though I did not get onto the show per se, I was greeted by Ms. Lyons, and all I can say is the lady always had time for children.
She did. That's an interesting point because that point's made, Bill, in the documentary as well, that she always had a little segment just for kids.
Right, yes. And I remember, of course, Bob Braun and the Mary Lou, the Midwestern Hayride, and all the whole gauntlet, you might say, mm-hmm. because that's what I was exposed to by my mother and father. My father is still living, and he still remembers that. His mind is quite good yet, real good, as a matter of fact. But that's the most vivid thing. She always had time for children, and she would interrupt something to say something to a child. And she did speak to me, hi, how are you, blah, blah, blah. And I still vividly remember that at my age now.
And one of the things that I don't think we've discussed yet is the fact that, you know, the Ruth Lyons Children's Fund, which provided toys and equipment to children.
And I want to get to that. I definitely want to get to it because they say, I mean, it was at the time, in its day, the biggest charity for children, and it still is considered until recently, I think, it's always done very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, all the proceeds from this documentary DVD, 100%, go to the Ruth Lyons Children's Fund.
Okay, well, it's a pretty amazing story, that in and of itself. Bill in Manchester, thanks for your call.
You're very welcome. Glad to be assistance there. Thank you.
We're going to continue our conversation about Ruth Lyons when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Oh, Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Those on the other side of the hiring table say the job market has improved. While Kazalia agrees the job market is beginning to rebound, she says salaries are not.
Employers are dealing with their own economic realities in terms of tightening the budgets a little bit. And so
hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News. It's 48 degrees with some rain likely today and a high of 53. More rain expected tonight, a low of 38 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way is working to improve lives and strengthen our community by bringing together people and organizations to address local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information on how to get involved is at liveunitedcentralohio.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the queen of television, Ruth Lyons. She hosted her 50-50 Club for 20 years on television. Before that, it was on radio. Give us a call and share your memory, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us from Cincinnati, Mickey Fisher. She was Ruth Lyons' executive secretary. Mickey, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Delighted.
And also still with us, Mark Magistrelli. He's creator, writer, and producer of the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television, the subject of the conversation today. Mark, thanks again for joining us. And Dave Powers, musician for the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. Dave, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
What was it like to produce the music for this documentary? Because she was an incredibly musical person and there were a lot of musical people that were involved in it.
Well, it was an honor to be a part of it, and my awareness with Ruth Lyons, of course, growing up in Columbus, I wasn't as aware of Ruth Lyons as I was aware of Bob Braun, who succeeded her.
Okay.
So I grew up with the Bob Braun Show and watching it here in Columbus, but knew about how all of that worked and the way that, you know, media has always been my thing besides music. So when David Ashbrock, the producer of the film, approached me. David and I did some corporate events together, and David, being a wonderful producer, he says, "We're working on a film about Ruth Lyons. We've been working on this film for about 3 years. We've got 90 minutes worth, and we're short on some music. Can you help us out?" I said, "I would love to. Count me in." And then Mark Magistrelli came along with David Ashbrock, and I was always a big fan. Every now and then I would listen to him. Mark had a radio show called When Swing Was King. He still does When Swing Was King. And so I was like, "I know who you are, too. You know, I'm all about, you know, I know who Ann Fisher is." And but we've done some events for WOSU as well. But going back to the film, Mark and David came over to my home, and they had so many musical cues that they were looking for, and I helped give it a certain feel that they were looking for, and I recorded it in my home. And so we did so many, I think, 30-something music cues.
And what you were doing, of course, was taking so many of Ruth Lyons' compositions and transcribing them because the sheet music may not have existed, or, you know, making sure that they were in the same key. For example, we have a recording at the very end of the program where the final few notes did not exist, so you created a little flourish at the end. It was things like that.
I had to create it, and I also had to pitch correct it.
That's right.
To make
That's
sure
right.
that it matched the pitch of your film,
right.
And it was perfect for the closing credits.
She was prolific as a songwriter. Amazing. And she had a perfect pitch in her brain, at least. She was very musically adept herself and often performed with some of her most esteemed guests on the show.
And I know that on the DVD, and Mickey, you probably remember the story as well. She walked out there one day when Johnny Mathis was
right.
the guest and said,
that
"I wrote a song.
Story.
You're going to love it."
Mickey, were you with her at that time when Johnny Mathis
was
on?
Absolutely.
Tell
us
that story. It's a great story.
My office was right outside her office, and I sat and listened to Johnny singing Wasn't the Summer Short, a song she had written, while she played the piano. And that was his first time of hearing about it, and he took it back and recorded it.
And he said on the in the interview on the DVD that, you know, how many times does someone like him and his producer or his agent hear, hey, I've got a great song for you to hear. And it's usually, you don't even want to listen to it. He says, we loved this song. He says, it's still one of his favorites.
I know. It's beautiful.
Let's hear from some of the listeners now. Paul and Bexley, you're on the air. You went to the show as a kid.
Yeah, did. It was about, I think I was like, must have been about 8 or 9. About was probably about 1958, I think. And we lived in Troy, which is about 80 miles away, and it was a big family event. My mom, my grandmother, my aunts, and my brother all went down and took the train and made a day of it. As I recall, it was lunch before the show, and it was quite an event. And I tell you, there's virtually every product that she advertised, everybody in the family bought, and I still buy the same brands.
She some people say she's in part responsible for the acceptance of the color television set.
Absolutely.
When it came out. Mickey, what about that?
Yes, absolutely, because when color television came out, we were doing RCA Victor at the time, and every day she would wear these colorful outfits, and she'd say, oh, you should see this beautiful red dress or this whatever. You can't believe what it looks like in color, blah, 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 blah. Well, everybody had to see Ruth Lyons in color, so they all went out and bought color TV sets. And Cincinnati was named Color Town USA because more color television sets were sold in the area than anywhere else in the country.
Twice as many as New York City.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the name Color Town USA, I found out after we locked production on this, came from Bobby Sarnoff, the general son and head of NBC. That is how important Cincinnati, Columbus, and Dayton were in establishing color television. There was no question about it.
Paul, did you remember your family getting a color television set?
We didn't for quite a while. Okay. My aunt was able to get it just because of financial situation.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, my aunt definitely got one about that time or shortly thereafter. And I do believe, didn't they advertise Tappan Ranges, Miss Mickey?
Tappan Ranges.
Okay,
I think that might have been before me. I don't remember.
Okay,
Tappan
I'll go
Ranges.
Quick story about
okay.
that. She seemed to have a thing that she did during the shows, and she said, if anybody can carry this Tappan Range off, they can have it. So my little brother, who's 4 years younger than I, we're sitting in the front row, and this little kid who's a very tiny little boy anyway, and I'm only 4 years older, he says, I will, me and my brother. So she calls us up there, and we're trying to pick this range up to carry it off. It was hysterical. I think about it now, I still feel totally embarrassed.
But everybody thought it was adorable.
Oh, it was adorable. Good thing there wasn't much tape back then. Where can we get the documentary? Because my mom is 87. She dearly loved Ruth and would love to see it. And is it closed captioned, I hope?
You know what? I have not turned on that feature. I believe it is. But at any event, here's the address, and you can find out more about it. Go on the web. It's www.RuthLyonsDVD.com. That's RuthLyonsDVD.com.
And we'll put that on our website. That's RuthLyonsDVD.com. We'll have it on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Paul, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about Ruth Lyons, the queen of television back in the 50s and 60s.
I believe that was what the Saturday Evening Post
she was
gave
actually,
her that title.
Yeah, actually
mm-hmm.
called that. They did lots of, there were lots of magazine stories about Ruth Lyons.
I think it was First Lady, wasn't it?
First Lady of television, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
First Lady of Broadcasting. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you would like to join the conversation. We have from an email from Debbie. She says, how exciting that you are featuring this amazing woman. I hope you will get a chance to speak of the Ruth Lyons Children's Christmas Fund. I don't know if it's still exists. A wonderful book was written about her called Before Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, you can appreciate that all the more when you listen to the or watch the DVD, the proceeds of which, the proceeds from the sales, will go to fund the mm-hmm. Ruth Lyons Children's Christmas Fund.
Yes.
Okay, tell us about that, because that was amazing.
Well, you know what? I'm going to turn that over
okay,
to Mickey,
Mickey,
because she was in charge
there.
Of the fund for many, many, many years.
Oh, yes. I worked very closely with Ruth when all the reports came in from the hospitals with what they had done with the money and what they really needed. I spent the day, Ruth would take the day off, and I would go to her house, and we'd go through all of the reports, and she dictated all these letters back to me, and we would award all the money.
How did it start, Mickey?
Beg your pardon?
How did it start?
How did it start?
Yeah.
At 1939, radio days,
okay.
She and her staff visited the Children's Hospital here in Cincinnati and was just shocked. It was, in the holiday time. She was shocked that there was no decorations. It was all stark white and she just thought, oh, this is terrible. So she went back, of course, and talked about it on her radio show. And the nickels and pennies and dimes started coming in, and she raised $1,000 the first year. They went out and bought decorations and toys and games, et cetera, and took them to the hospital and gave presents to the kids, decorated the wards, and that's how it started.
And by the time 1967, when she retired, it was raising a lot more money by then.
Yes. Actually, the last year that I was the coordinator from 1993 until 2000 when I retired, and the final fund at that time was like $750,000.
Not bad.
No. But it was millions. I mean, over the years, mm-hmm. It was in the millions.
Right. We have an email from Kirk. He said the 50-50 Club was kind of a soundtrack to my grade school days. It was on every day, either at home or at my grandmother's house. The saving grace for me was that she was a huge fan of the Cincinnati Reds and occasionally had players on as guests. She wrote a song about the Reds to the tune of Rally Round the Flag during the team's drive to the 1961 National League pennant. If I recall correctly, Ed Bailey was her favorite player, and she had quite an on-air tizzy when the Reds traded him to San Francisco. My mom and her buddies ordered tickets to the show in maybe 1959. They got tickets, but the earliest available show was sometime in 1962. The day they went to the Cincinnati for the show, Ruth was off for some reason, and they were disappointed. I wanted to call up on Mary in Columbus now. You wanted to talk about her all-star vote for the Reds baseball team. Welcome, Mary.
Hello.
Tell us about what you remember.
I just remember writing many, many postcards with all the Reds players for the voting for the All-Star team.
Yeah.
And we got all eight of them on.
Yeah, which is when, Mark, I think it said in the documentary, that's when things changed.
Yeah, they had to change the rules. And, Mickey, you were
exactly.
there. You told the story.
I remember.
But
Yeah,
you were saying that, go ahead, so many ladies filled in their ballots the way Ruth told them to. What happened?
Every player on the team, every position was filled with a Cincinnati Red.
It's pretty amazing. Mary, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth had a lot of power. We talked about what she could get people to do when it came to the All-Star lineup. She went up against the business establishment without hesitation. When Albers, if you've never heard of it, it's no surprise. It was the grocery store that she pitched on her show for many years. When it was sold to an outfit in Atlanta, things changed pretty quickly.
So they send up
big mistake.
A young man who is one of the advertising executives, and he watches the show once or twice, and he goes home and says, no good at all. Forget it. Well... Albers was dropped. Kroger came in like that. Within less than a year, Albers was out of business.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing, but not to the people who knew her power. Mark, tell us who that was talking and in the documentary.
The people you heard were Mary Wood, principally telling the story, and you also heard a few bits and pieces from Ruth's first TV director, the late Gene Walls, and Nick Clooney was in on that conversation as well. I think one thing that we forget, because the media landscape has changed somewhat, and we were able to present the figures because he asked for them, but when we spoke to David Letterman, and he knew firsthand because he watched the show with his mother, but he said, do you have any idea what her ratings were like? And so I found some documentation and gave it to Dave, and he started giggling. It was a 70 share
Yes, yeah, primetime ratings.
It's like having the Super Bowl 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. Seven out of 10 sets in the viewing area, by which I mean Columbus, Dayton, Cincinnati primarily, were tuned to this program. 7 out of 10, you will never see that or it's like again. So when an Albers decides, oh, we're going to go a different direction, and Mickey, correct me if I'm wrong, but hadn't Kroger's been waiting for quite some time?
Yes, they were on the abeyance list.
And the abeyance list was, explain that to us, because we don't know.
It was sponsors who wanted to get on the show, but there was not a spot, or if it was a conflicting product or whatever, they waited on the list and to get to the top. And
it could be years, too, right?
Absolutely.
Just like for tickets.
And sometimes never.
Because she might not.
On that New Made Margarine was on. I mean, it never went off. Phil's Naphtha. I mean, that was on for all the time that I know.
And, of course, the town known for Procter & Gamble, Phil's Naphtha, was not part of the Procter & Gamble lineup.
Right. Well, P&G was not. We didn't have any P&G products on the air. They were a little PO'd at our station because they couldn't figure out, everybody couldn't figure out why the soap operas weren't on in Cincinnati from 12 to 1:30 like they were everywhere else. They wanted Ruth to move her show, and she said absolutely not. Well, there were at the time there had been a couple P&G products. They dropped them. Well, she, of course, got another product that was just as good, and they went to number one. So P&G was not a fan of our show.
And keep in mind, too, as you were mentioning, Mickey, when she was on at noon rather than the P&G soap operas, that wasn't just in Cincinnati.
Oh, no.
It was in Dayton. Yeah. It was in Columbus. Yeah. Indianapolis,
Dayton,
eventually.
Indianapolis, yeah.
Pretty populous wedge of the country. Kathleen in Urbana, you're on the air. You have a story to tell. Welcome.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, well, when you talk about Ruth Lyons, it brings back a lot of really nice memories. The first time I think that I ever saw her was when I'm a very senior citizen right now, but anyway, I was probably about 8 or 9, and we went to a wedding in Cincinnati. My mother was from Cincinnati, and we went down to one of our cousins' weddings, and the reception was being held at what was then the Hotel Alms on Victory Parkway down in Cincinnati. And mother always listened to the radio. I mean, that we first knew of Ruth through the radio, and we went to WKRC. They had their studios there in the Hotel Alms.
WKRP? Okay.
No, WKRC.
KRC. Okay, gotcha.
And so we left the reception. This is my mother's nephew's reception. And she said, well, we're going to go over and see Ruth Lyons. We'll be back. So so we didn't have tickets or anything, but I guess we must have just been able to walk in. And there were folding chairs, and we sat there for the show. And, of course, we were all dressed up, and I think they put us in the front row because we were little. And my brother Joe was with me and mother. And so anyway, she came over and talked to us, and she wanted to know, why we were so dressed up, and we were telling her. And then she said, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, well, I want to be a nurse, and everybody wanted to be a nurse. And my brother Joe said he wanted to be a garbage collector. And, and she was just, real sweet with it. And she really was. She was a wonderful person. My mother loved her until the day she died. Until Ruth went off the air, mother listened to her faithfully every day. And you could go up and down our street in the summertime, and you never missed a, Ruth Lyons show because the doors would be open and everybody'd have her on. And it was just, she was just great. And, she had, I know Mickey would tell the story, but, she had had a very tragic thing happen in her life when her young daughter died.
Right.
And mother always said that she never thought, Ruth was ever the same again. And, of course, I don't think it was too long after that she retired. But anyway, she's a great lady. And I must get that DVD. My sister-in-law and I would both enjoy seeing it. And I will say my sister-in-law had 6 children. And I think when she was pregnant with one of the kids, she went down with her sisters to the show. And she used to have a sponsor of shoes. I don't remember. I don't think the company's in business anymore. But at that time, they gave away like a certificate for shoes for your kids. And so the S2 had the most children, and I think at that time she had five. And so she got a certificate for shoes for the five kids, and they were just thrilled to death.
Well, that's a bonanza right there. Kathleen,
yeah, right.
Thanks for your call, Kathleen.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We will return to our conversation about Ruth Lyons, the first lady of broadcast television, when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Barbra Streisand is one of a very few entertainers who have won it all, an Oscar, Emmy, Grammy, and a Tony Award. She's starring in the new film, The Guilt Trip, along with Seth Rogen. On the next Fresh Air, we look back at a 50-year career that includes hit songs, hit films, and one distinctive voice. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us tomorrow for Tech Tuesday, a discussion of the top tablets and how to shop for them, and then some more gift ideas. It's Tech Tuesday tomorrow during All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join WOSU-TV Wednesday night when nature follows the snowy footprints of Yellowstone's red foxes and climbs into the den of a grizzly bear. Nature, Christmas in Yellowstone is a breathtaking look at wintertime deep within America's first national park. Watch Nature, Christmas in Yellowstone. That's Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. Expect some rain today and a high of 53. More rain tonight, a low of 38 degrees. A chance of morning rain Tuesday, then we'll see some sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 47. Partly cloudy Tuesday night, a low of 35. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Broadcast. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking with Mickey Fisher. She was Ruth's former executive secretary, and also Mark Magistrelli. He's the creator, writer, and producer of the documentary we're talking about today. It's called Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. And we'll have an email address for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about how to get a copy of that DVD. The proceeds of the sales go to fund Ruth's Christmas charity for children. Also with us, Dave Powers. He wrote much of the music for the documentary, Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. I want to listen to a little bit more from the documentary. Ruth was known for ad-libbing her commercials, a tact that irritated advertisers, no end, some of them, but endeared her to the fans. Here she's talking about that amazing new invention of whipped cream in a can.
Perfect, honest-to-goodness cream. No synthetic deal. Real cream in the handiest, smartest idea that's been evolved in a long time. In a can to be kept right in the refrigerator, cold. All you do is remove that nice plastic top that seals so that you get it fresh. Press it with one finger. Always shake it a little first. Press it, and you have mountains of luscious whipped cream for your pies and puddings and cakes and everything delicious.
And that is still out there for sale. But what was it about her ad-libbing that the advertisers just didn't seem to get it because they would fight her on that, right, Mark?
Well, I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is, I think we may have touched upon this a little bit earlier, is that things were very controlled. The ad agencies had the copy, the announcer or whomever did what they were told to do. And here's this lady who has not used a script since 1929 saying, I'm doing it my way. And when she was on NBC's full network, one of the first shows of its type, circa 1951, 1952, there was apparently quite a bit of conflict between Ruth Lyons and the sponsors that the network just assumed, okay, they're going to run their filmed commercials or we'll have somebody doing exactly the copy that's here. There would be times that she would actually make fun of the copy if it was just too ridiculous on the air and share that with her viewers.
So some of these people really didn't want to go that route because it was too radical. Who was doing this? Why can't they just run what we give them? But as it turned out, you know, Ruth Lyons knew exactly what she was doing because this was the personalized approach that not only worked for her, but allowed her, rather than some fellow writing copy in New York City, to say, this is what I think my viewers are going to find most important.
Well, I have a cute little story. There was a young little boy on the show, and Ruth called him up, and she was talking to him, and she says, well, what's your favorite part of the show? And he said, the commercials. The commercials. He loved the commercials. Now, what does that say?
Well, you know, one thing, what part of her tack was that sometimes she didn't know where the program ended and the commercial picked up.
That's correct. That's
she would
right.
just weave it in and out of the copy of the show.
Seamless. It was seamless.
And another thing, Mickey, that I think you'll remember is when there was a really big guest on the program, if she had 18 to 20 sponsors, let's say it was 18, she might do all 18, boom,
yeah.
boom, boom,
yeah,
straight in a row.
Yeah, she'd zip right through them.
Just to get it over
and
with.
And sometimes they would get 20 seconds. Well, but then the next time they might get a minute and a half. I mean, you know, I don't ever remember anybody complaining, frankly. I mean, the products,
once they started selling,
shelves.
Right. Right. Dale in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Hi. I used to watch Ruth Lyons with my grandmother. It was mandatory growing up here in Columbus back in the early 60s. And two things I remember about the show specifically were when anybody came to the show, they would turn the cameras around and you could wave to the people at home.
Right.
And yes, she wrote a song.
I thought that was a wonderful gesture on her behalf. Also, the power of regional television at the time, we don't really have that anymore, and she was really a pioneer in that department with WLW and WLWC and Indianapolis and all those different stations. Really a phenomenon we don't have today. And the last thing I wanted to share with you, the fact that she would not talk into a conventional microphone.
Oh, yes.
Into a bouquet of flowers.
Right.
And I never understood that, but my grandmother explained it once, but I forget what the reason was.
Well, Mickey Fisher, tell us about that, because that's quite something.
Oh, well, you know, back in the early days, they had these big, long sticks that she would be carrying, you know, around, and the big, long cord, and it was just, it looked terrible, and she decided it looked terrible. She said, I got to do something. So her producer, George Riesing at the time, went to Kappel's, I believe, and they made up some bouquets of flowers, different colors, so that they could match her outfit, whatever she wore each day, and they put it on the microphone. And that was the way it began.
There you go, Dale. That's the story.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. And it was fresh flowers every day, right, Mickey?
Well, no, they looked real, but they had, at first they did some fresh flowers, but then they decided, let's just do a bunch, but they all looked real, but they were not real.
I would think fresh flowers might wilt underneath all that light.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, I was kind of surprised at first. Hey, Mickey Fisher, I wondered about this, and finally you got to it in the documentary about Ruth Lyons' personal life. I thought, here's somebody who just must be going 24/7 because everybody wants to invite Ruth Lyons to their parties and their events. But she actually had quite a private life and didn't socialize.
Yes, she would stay around a little while after the show. In fact, we would play bridge maybe for an hour or so just for her to wind down. Or if a guest wanted to stay and chat, she would do that. And sometimes we would have a client meeting. But when she left that studio, she went home to Colwain Avenue to her beautiful home there, and she was Mrs. Herman Newman with her daughter Candy. She was not a partier. She never threw parties. She never went to parties. Hardly. I mean, I think maybe Cliff Lash was her most, you know, guest that came the most often because they, you know, wrote things together, et cetera. But she was quite a private person, yes, ma'am.
She, you must have been turning down a lot of invitations for her, though, I would imagine.
Absolutely. But, you know, after a while, they learned. They stopped inviting because they just knew that she was just Mrs. Newman, and she enjoyed her home and her family after the show. But she, you know, when she was at show, I mean, she was very outgoing and with, you know, talked, you know, with people and stuff. But after that, at home, it was just the family.
Something that Mark Magistrelli brought up a little earlier and I wanted to go into a little bit deeper was her how early on she took up the issue of civil rights and racism. She was way ahead of her time. Phil Donahue talked about that quite a bit on the documentary. Can you tell a little bit about us about a little bit about that, Mickey, and also the flack she received from some of the listeners and viewers, and then the support she received from others?
Well, probably the most famous one was when we used to have the guests from the Beverly Hills Country Club, which unfortunately burned down, as everybody knows, and Arthur Lee Simpkins, a beautiful black man who had the most fantastic voice, came to the program, and Ruth was talking to him, and she noticed he wasn't really, really comfortable. He was kind of nervous, and she said, "I bet you're a great dancer," and she said, "Come on," and she got up, and she was dancing around. And, oh, my God, I was in the office answering the phones, and they were ringing off the wall with these horrible people calling her all kinds of names. It's just awful. Well, of course, after the show, I told her about all the phone calls. Well, the next day she got on the air, and she lambasted people for their, you know, unmitigated gall and racism and all that. Well, the letters poured in, and, I mean, it was like 9 out of 10 were all applauding her for her stand. So she was right. I mean, the majority of the people were on her side.
It was really interesting how descriptive she got about some of the letters she received and the criticism from the calls and how many people said, "How would you like it if your daughter dated or danced with a black man or whatever, that, you know, some kind of thing?" And she said, "That would be all right with me."
Right. And she says, "If he comes back, I will do it again if he comes back to the program." So, I mean, she was very principled, and she stood by, you know, her feelings.
Did you want to say something, Dave Powers? Okay.
Well, I really like how Phil Donahue described it. But the other part of that story was where she invited his wife onto the show.
Oh, that's right.
And her co-host, assistant, Peter Grant.
Yeah, it was Peter Grant.
Came up and danced with his wife. So
she danced with him, yeah.
Absolutely.
And although the video doesn't exist, we have some stills. So what was happening is that off on one side, Arthur Lee Simpkins and Ruth Lyons were apparently, judging from the audio track, doing the same dance to Marie that had gotten some flack to begin with, while Peter Grant and Mrs. Arthur Lee Simpkins are off doing this twist in front of the set.
That's just brilliant.
You know, I love the emotion that sent her in that direction in the first place, Mickey, the fact that she wanted to make him feel comfortable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she had a tremendous sense of when she was talking with people. I mean, Kitty Callan was a guest on the program, and she had gotten some kind of a phobia where she couldn't even sing in front of an audience anymore. And Ruth made her so comfortable that she got up and sang. I mean, that's the kind of... You know,
and she kind of did it right on the fly there while they were. She was on the show. She wasn't planning on doing it, but Ruth.
Right.
And she said
she was amazing.
Yeah.
And she thanked her afterwards, you know, that how wonderful and, you know, how comfortable she made her feel. And it's just almost a miracle.
Yeah.
And speaking of miracle, I do have a little cute story. Her one Christmas song, the Christmas marching song, which she wrote for the kids, and we were doing the show, and she said, "Okay, kids, let's get up and let's do the Christmas marching song." Well, of course, all the kids came up and they were, you know, marching around the sofa, et cetera. Well, I got a phone call. I'm in the studio and I get this phone call, and it's this woman, and she is just boohooing and crying. And I can hardly understand her, but her youngster had been unable. He hadn't even tried to walk. He had something wrong. But when she told the kids to get up and march to the song, this kid got up and walked around the chair. I mean, this is power.
Yeah. Patty in Columbus, you have a quick story. Welcome to the show. Hi, Patty.
Yes.
You might want to turn off your TV or your radio.
Okay, I can do that.
All
right. Got it.
All righty. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I went to Whetstone High School, class of 71, and my very best friend was Linda Scott, and her parents, Helen and Billy Scott, were entertainers on the Ruth Lyons Show. Do any of you remember her?
Yes, I remember Helen and Billy. They were on the Midwestern Hayride also.
Okay. Thank you, Patty, for that call. We appreciate it. I wanted to get back to a little Ruth Lyons music before we run out of time. In 1958, she struck gold again with music, this time the album 10 Tunes of Christmas. This is from what I heard from the documentary.
In 1958, an album selling 50,000 copies was considered a national hit. 10 Tunes of Christmas, available only in the four-city region covered by the Crosby TV stations, sold over 250,000 copies.
Wow. You have to chuckle about that, huh, Mickey?
Yeah, I remember that well.
She went on to produce three more albums.
She had three albums.
And she produced, did she write all the songs for all the albums or much of the?
Yeah, she wrote, all of them. Yes, she only recorded songs she wrote.
She was quite gifted. She could sit down to the piano and add.
I mean, she wrote songs riding to the station in a cab at a stoplight.
Right.
She would come in and say, "Cliff, play this," and she would go, you know, did it, whatever, and he would start playing. It's amazing. She had this uncanny ability to perfect pitch, and she wrote words and music. She didn't. Cliff is the actual arranger. She didn't really actually write that most of the time. Mm-hmm. Although I do have some copies of some of her, music that she wrote. So she did do some of it.
It sounds complicated, but she made it all look very, very easy. Was she fun to work for?
Oh my God, yes. She was the most. I mean, most.
They
fun.
Called her
she,
mother.
She loved. I beg your pardon?
They called her mother.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody did, because you could come to her with anything, and she would, anything you know she could do to help you, she did. I mean, she was the first one when Paul Dixon's son was tragically killed. I mean, she was the first one to Paul to, you know, to offer anything she could do to help him. She was just a wonderful human being. I mean, I can't tell you. It was the most wonderful years of my life. I always said that it was not a job. It was a joy. I really loved going to work every day.
Well, thank you so much, Mickey Fisher, for sharing your memories of Ruth Lyons with us today. We really appreciate it.
I am so glad that you're talking about her and still you're still playing her music, and I'm delighted. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
And Mark, nice to talk to you.
Mark Magistrelli, creator, writer, and producer of the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. Mark, once again, thank you.
Thanks so much for having us here.
And Dave Powers, musician for the documentary Ruth Lyons, First Lady of Television. Dave, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Ann.
You can go to our website for a link for more information about the DVD. It's WSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.